I'm really excited to be here today with Bill Dembski, who is related to the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. He's an author. He's written many books. He has a doctorate in mathematics from the University of Chicago, a doctorate in philosophy from the University of Illinois in Chicago, and a master's in divinity from Princeton Theological Seminary. And right now, he's also working on some online technologies, doing educational software, as well as his work for the Discovery Institute. And Bill, I'm really happy to have you here. And I hope you can tell us what it was that got you involved with this whole mathematical issue of specified complexity and the no free lunch theorem.
Good. Well, nice to meet you, Karen. Let me back up a little bit. I mean, these ideas that I've been dealing with when you mentioned specified complexity, it's a method or criterion for detecting design. So the thing is, we as we go through life, it's a very natural question to ask whether something came about by randomness, natural causes. Something where there was no intention behind it, at least as far as we know, or whether there was an intention, whether there was a design behind it. So if you go through Southwest South Dakota, you'll see various mountains there. Most of them, you'll just say, well, they formed by wind and erosion. But there's one mountain in particular, Mount Rushmore, where if you look at it, there are features there which will tell you that you're dealing with an intelligent cause. And we would know that even if we didn't know the causal story about Gutzon Burglum, the person who carved that sculpture over the course of, I think, about 30 years. So it's a very basic question, and it's a matter of human, if you will, practical reason, distinguishing between what's the result of chance? What's the result of design? So it's a very fundamental distinction. Many special sciences do that. You think about search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Most of the signals that we get from outer space are noise. In fact, it seems that all of them have been noise to date. But could there be something about a signal that would reliably tell us that we're dealing with an intelligence? Archaeology, as we go around the world, when we look at things, is it a burial mound? Is it a naturally formed mound? Is this an arrowhead? Is it just a random chunk of rock? So that's another place where we draw these distinctions. So my work, I mean, it was motivated in large part because of looking at biological systems and saying, are there signs of intelligence in biological systems? And what would it take to have a reliable mathematical statistical method for identifying the effects of intelligence in biology? Now, the majority position in the biological community is that there's no design there, that a Darwinian process of blind variation coupled with natural selection can produce all of the appearance of design that we see in nature, but there's no actual design there. So that's the dominant view. So that was the preliminary, the background in my approaching this, thinking it seemed to me that there was just that it was almost self-evident that there was actual design in biology, the sorts of complexity, an adaptation of means to ends. And it seemed to me that was well beyond what the Darwinian mechanism of natural selection acting on random variation could produce. So,
Could we back up just a little bit
yeah.
before that? So you're a student. Before you got your doctorate in mathematics, what was your background?
Oh, I mean, I was I did actually an undergrad in psychology, and then I was a graduate student in psychology for several years. But I worked in experimental psych methods and measurements, and so I had to do a lot of statistics. And so then I pivoted to mathematics actually after my second year in grad school. So I left one program, went to another. But that was but I always had a love for mathematics, and that was. That's kind of the background there, but
So then you get into mathematics, and while you're in mathematics, you get interested in this biology question, or was that always in your mind when you went into mathematics?
I mean, the thing is, I was mathematically adept right along. So, I mean, I was reading even as an undergraduate about origin of life studies, for instance, and it just seemed to me inconceivable that brute chemistry could organize itself into what you'd need for a minimum viable cell. Okay, so I mean, I remember reading a book about this topic on the subway to school in Chicago. I mean, so the I looked at the origin of life, and for me, it was a slam dunk that there was intelligence behind it. Now, not many people have come to the opposite conclusion. I mean, there's a fellow named Lee Strobel, who subsequently has come on board with intelligent design. But when he was a high school student, he learned of something called the Miller-Urey experiment, whereby sparking a chemical solution with methane, ammonia, and various things, you got out some basic amino acids, some building blocks for life. But it turns out that they were in tars, so they were unusable. I mean, there were all sorts of good reasons for thinking that this was not a plausible prebiotic path to life originating. But for me, it just seemed the probabilities were against it. And so, but just because something is improbable doesn't mean that it won't happen. I mean, I can throw a bunch of marbles on the row on my floor here, 1,000 marbles, and the precise configuration that they take is going to be vastly improbable. But if they spell out "Welcome to the meaning code," then I'm going to say, wait a second, there is something guiding those marbles to take that form, even if I don't know what the causal story was there. And this
Oh,
is
so
really.
then there's a difference between improbability and complex specified information.
That's right. So, I mean, improbability is just the how improbable is it for something to happen. But then when you have the match with a pattern, an independently given pattern, that's when things, become interesting. I mean, that's the sort of, when if you're a fan of the mystery genre, it's, when a coincidence is no longer just a coincidence, but when it's something that clues you in that there is foul play. Well, foul play is design. Natural causes, if somebody dies by natural causes, that's chance. So again, there's this opposition between chance and design. And so it's a question of getting what are the logical and statistical underpinnings by which we infer design. Okay, and that was my first book, The Design Inference. I published it with Cambridge University Press in 1998. It was a big deal when it came out. It sold very well, and it probably would have been a way for me to get a good academic position. Except that I immediately applied these ideas to biology, and that was a bridge too far as the scientific community was concerned, because they didn't want these ideas being applied there. And
Well, before we head down that road, could you give us just a little, you wrote a book about it, so I know it's hard to summarize it, but could you give us a summary of what complex specified information is and what kind of calculations are required for that?
So I mean, complex specified information or specified complexity. I mean, the actual term I mean, they're the same thing. Specified complexity is a term that's been around for about 50 years. It was actually introduced by an origin of life researcher named Leslie Orgel. And it bears some similarities to where I've taken the concept. The thing is, he really didn't develop it in a full fledged theoretical way. I mean, there was quite a bit of hand waving there. So let's just call it specified complexity. So the complexity there is improbability. And we can think of that as if I flip a coin 100 times, the improbability of that, or the probability, is 1/2 to the 100. You keep the probabilities multiplied, because coin flipping, the individual flips are independent of each other. So the thing is, that's 1/2 to the 100. It's about 1 in 10 to the 30. So very small number, 1 in a trillion trillion million. But you can also think of it in terms of bits. How many bits does it take to characterize that sequence of coin tosses? It could be head, tails, and so on. And so if you let head be one, tails be zero, then you can get a sequence of length 100 that will carry, that will precisely identify this, the coin tosses. So probabilities and number of bits are directly related. So 1 in 2 to the 100 probability, it corresponds to 100 bits of information. And so you can move back and forth, and there's a straightforward mathematical relation where basically you take a logarithm to get from probabilities to bits, and you go from to get from bits to probability, basically take an exponent. And so the thing is, it's convenient for some purposes to think of information in terms of bits, because I mean we do this. I mean, right now we're communicating via Zoom, which is a digital technology, and everything that we're seeing ultimately will go down to strings of zeros and ones that are being transmitted across the communication channel here, up and back between us. So anyway, long story short, complexity and probability are basically the same notion. It's just that one is dressed up in a different garb. But the thing is, as we
I
said,
asked a question about that because I'm trying
sure.
to wrap my head around this a little bit. crystalline structures are very orderly, and it would seem like that they might actually be improbable the way that they structure themselves sometimes. I'm thinking of a lecture from a, can't quite think of her name right now. She's a particle physicist, and she was doing some research on how particles organize, and she was using particles that had been synthetically produced that were all exactly the same size and shape, and putting them into a container. And as the space around the particles was reduced and reduced and reduced, the particles began to form into a crystalline shape inside the container. By and she said, this is happening solely on the basis of entropy. And I thought to myself, well, not really, because you're affecting the space that they're in. The space that they're inhabited is being affected by your design and how you're removing the space around them. But does that make any sense to you why I have a question about that and how it
I mean, it's the thing is, when she's talking entropy, I'm assuming thermodynamics second law is behind this. And the thing is, with the second law and entropy, what we're talking about is thermal order and disorder. And the idea there with thermal order is that you've got it, the more concentrated the heat is, the more work, mechanical work you can do. And if it's dissipated, you can do less work. So this is not what we're really talking about here. If you want, where it's not so much thermal order or disorder, it's configurational or formational order and disorder. It's putting parts together in ways that that serve some role, have a function, do something.
would that relate to algorithmic complexity?
It does. I mean, that would be one way of characterizing it. So, for instance, the algorithmic complexity, where the idea there is how short a program can you write that will produce a given output. And it turns out that for a crystal, for instance, it's usually a very short program because it's basically saying repeat this over and over again. So with with the sort of configurational entropy or configurational order, the improbabilities end up actually not being very bad. I mean, it's not that you have a small probability for a crystal. I mean, and the thing is, when you assign a probability, it has to be in relation to the actual physical processes that are going on there. You can't just say, well, gee, this looks all very symmetric, so we're just going to slap a uniform or equally probable distribution on. You have to actually ask what are the processes involved and what are the actual probabilities involved. But
Well,
typically,
has anybody ever run the numbers on DNA as to what the complexity is of how short the program could be that would spit out DNA as a program?
yeah, I'm not sure algorithmic complexity is so much the technique that you want to go with in that case. But the thing is, the combinatorial possibilities with DNA and the proteins that they code for are immense. I mean, you've got 20 different amino acids, and they can be stitched together any number of ways. So an average protein, eukaryotic protein, I think has about 400, 450 amino acids. And so in terms of the total possibilities, it's 20 to the 400 or 450. So the thing is, when you hear those sorts of improbabilities, you'd say, well, that just couldn't happen by chance. But there's some subtleties that need to be factored in there. For one, you'll have amino acids that are hydrophobic, hydrophilic. So any given protein will allow a fair number of substitutions and still perform the same function. Once you factor that in, you still have something that's vastly improbable. But then the thing is, it's not that these proteins are magically materializing. I mean, from a Darwinian perspective, they've evolved from other proteins that were doing something else. And so what you have is some sort of co-evolutionary pathway in which a protein is changing structure, and then its function changes, structure changes, function changes, and then eventually you can get to this novel protein that's under consideration. At least that's the theory, that's the idea there. The question is, what are the details? The devil's always in the details. And does that actually happen for particular proteins? Now, you have in your backyard in California probably the most significant person who's addressed this question. This is Douglas Axe, AXE, at Biola University. He's also a senior fellow at Discovery Institute, as am I. But he's looked at that. And so even though you have these vast improbabilities of, where basically you take the number of amino acids and then raise it to whatever the number of amino acids that are being polymerized or stitched together in sequence, he will, for instance, look at the evolution of various protein folds. And so he's going to get numbers, improbabilities. This one paper that he did with Journal of Molecular Biology, I mean, he was getting numbers on the order of 10 to the minus 60, 10 to the minus 77. So 1 in 10 to the 60, which would be 1 in a trillion, 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 trillion. So this is, highly improbable. It's I think the work is compelling. It's the probabilities themselves. You don't calculate them on first principles by simply looking at the geometry of the chemistry. A lot of what you have to do is actually run experiments. So he would take, basically, what he would do is he would take a given protein fold. It was for a beta-lactamase where he was looking where the function was antibiotic resistance that was being conferred. And then he was perturbing it and seeing how far you could perturb it and still retain function, and then what it would take to evolve into, as it were, this neighborhood of possibilities around it so that you could actually evolve into it. And so it's a sophisticated argument. I have a book called The Design of Life in which I summarize the work, as I co-authored that with Jonathan Wells. This came out, it's now over 15 years ago. But anyway, that's the sort of rationale that you need to do. So, I mean, the thing is, probabilities, often there are theoretical ways of calculating them. So with a die, for instance, it's a perfect homogeneous cube. The faces don't care what's written on them. And so if you roll it, any face is going to be as probable as any other. But in real scientific context, often what you need are not theoretical, but empirically derived probabilities. So you actually have to run some experiments and see what they are. And Douglas Axe has done just that. But let me return to, the question of just improbability plus what, because we were talking about specified complexity. So complexity, actually in my book, The Design Inference, I never used the term specified complexity. I was talking about specified improbability. So improbability and complexity are the same notions. But then what is that word specified doing there? And the thing is, you need something more than just brute improbability. And one way I've illustrated this is, let's imagine that you're an archer, you've got a large wall, let's say it's 50 yards from you, and the arrowhead is very very precise, very pointed, and the wall is very large. So the precise place where an arrow is going to land on the wall is going to be highly improbable, just done by chance. But now let's have two possibilities. One, you shoot an arrow at the wall and then you paint a target around the arrow so that the arrow is squarely in the bullseye. Something highly improbable has happened, but the pattern that's being matched in that case tells you nothing about the skill of the archer. It tells you nothing about the design and the trajectory of that arrow. But if you fix the target and then the archer is hitting the bullseye and does so repeatedly, then it really becomes obligatory to say this is a skilled archer. So there's a design inference that's drawn. So you're not simply saying this was the result of chance, but you're saying it's the result of design. And so it's but what is the difference in those patterns? In the one pattern, the target was adapted to where the arrow landed. So it was dependent on the event. It was read off of the event, if you will. In the other case, the target was fixed and then the arrow landed on it. So in the second case, and that's the one that's the interesting one, you have specified complexity. There's this complexity, but then it's also matching a specification or a pattern. In this case, it's a pattern that's set in advance of the event. So it's really a pre-specification. The challenge that I faced in writing the design inference is that many of the patterns that we use to defeat chance are discovered after the fact. So for instance, if we want to apply these ideas to biology, biology is already here. It's not like we have a target and then we run an experiment. It's biology is here. What about the patterns could convince us that we're actually dealing with an intelligent agent? And the thing is, there are many patterns that we can discover after the fact that still convince us that we are dealing with an intelligence. One homespun example that I've used is father and mother are celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary, and their five children give them presents. The first present is a plate and dessert for a given set of china. The next is teacups and saucers, same set of china. The next is I don't know, some soup bowl or something, same set of china. You get the idea. I mean, it's now when the parents open all these presents, do they say, well, gee, it's nice that just happened that way. Our children just randomly decided to buy this these various china dishes, and it's nice that they all matched up so perfectly. Or do you say there was collusion? Obviously it was collusion. But the thing is, the parents didn't suspect that in advance, as with the target before an arrow is shot, they didn't suspect that that there would be this collusion. They had no idea, but just the way the events unfolded and this match with the pattern convinced them that they were dealing with intelligence. And so that was really the biggest challenge in writing the design inference, is coming up with a robust theory of specification, the types of patterns that in the presence of complexity or improbability we use to defeat chance. Sort of the rule of thumb, or the easy way to think about it, is independently given patterns. But there's a whole theory, and actually the theory depends on the sort of algorithmic information, Kolmogorov information. I mean, it draws inspiration from that, because what ends up happening is the patterns that we use to defeat chance in the presence of improbability are those that have a small description length. So there are these very efficiently described patterns that nonetheless clue us in that we're dealing with design. Let me just
So,
give you.
up to this point, you've been talking about, I would say, quantifiable patterns, quantifiable design. And I would just like to maybe explain to you very briefly the reason I got interested in this stuff is because I'm an artist. And through my study of art and design principles in art, I realized that. And this is just something that has been observed throughout all the centuries. It isn't something that somebody wrote down and said, okay, we're all going to paint this way. It's just they've looked at all these paintings and what were the principles of design that popped out that you could tell were happening through the artists, even through artists that aren't conscious of these principles of design. So you can take a painting and you can look at a painting, some famous painting hanging in a museum, and you can determine what is the proportion of light to dark, and what is the proportion of complementary colors to each other, and what is the proportion of balance, and what is the proportion of repetition, and what is the proportion of variation and of gradation? And you can look at the rhythm that's operating through the piece, and you can figure out how unity was managed and how it exhibits harmony in the way that it all ties together. And these are all principles that you might call qualities. And yet, if there are specified qualities that show up in art, and so I began to get this idea maybe 20 years ago or so that those qualities also show up everywhere else in the universe. And so one of the reasons I started my channel 5 years ago was to talk to people like you and see where I could find those qualities showing up in all these different arenas of science and physics and chemistry, biology, all of that. And it's been very interesting because they show up everywhere. So I think you have both the quantifiable information and the quality information in the work.
Well, and I think the quantifiable is going to miss something, obviously, in the art, but it can still capture something. So even the qualities, it seems, if you're looking so for certain proportions of
Yes.
light
And
and
those are
dark,
quantities for sure. Yeah.
you can calculate the quantities, and you'll have then a whole array of quantities, and that can provide something of a signature. And so that could also be a way, if there's a typical set of quantities associated with qualities, and then if you have a significant violation, because most things follow a normal distribution, so if you're way outside of it, then you might draw an inference that this wasn't painted by a human. Maybe it was in, or came about by some other means. So so even in that case, I see something like a design inference potentially at play.
Yeah. Well, so keep going.
Yeah.
I
Well,
didn't derail you.
no. I mean, this is all good. So really, what you have then is, with this notion of specified complexity, you have to have that complexity or improbability, and you need the pattern. And it's I say independently given pattern, but in terms of caching this out rigorously, we do it in terms of minimum description length, which draws inspiration from algorithmic information theory, or Kolmogorov information, which you adverted to. So the idea there is, I think an easy way to illustrate it is, think of poker hands. So five cards. There are about 22.6 million different poker hands. Now I can just give you a description. Let me give you two descriptions. They have the same length, approximately. One is a pair, and the other royal flush. Okay, so a single pair, let's say. So it's just a single pair. or royal flush. Single pair doesn't really narrow things down very much. Takes you, I think there are about a million possibilities there. So a million out of 2.6 million, it's maybe what, two-fifths or something like this, probability of getting that. And so if you see a single pair, you're not going to think anything special. On the other hand, if somebody tells you royal flush, that's likely to raise your antenna. It turns out that the probability of a royal flush is about 1 in 700,000, so it's a much smaller probability. Now, the thing is, with all the poker being played in the world, people will see royal flushes now and again. But I'm just trying to provide an intuition pump. There's something about royal flush, if you were to witness that, which would make you more likely to say, oh, there was cheating, there was design, as opposed to just a single pair. So it's that description length, that short description length, coupled with the improbability, that is what gets you to the design inference. And so, so many of the systems that we see in biology, they have a short description in terms of their function. There are only so many things that answer to that function, and vastly more that don't. And so you get a very natural probability with these sorts of specifications. And they are specifications because they are, it's that brevity of description that, in coupled with improbability, gets you to the design inference. We can turn it around. Anything can be described with given a long enough description. I mean, I can imagine in Unicode a sequence of maybe 1,000, 2,000 bits, and in Unicode it spells out Hamlet's soliloquy. Okay, if you see those bits as Hamlet's soliloquy, Hamlet's soliloquy is a short description of that sequence, and it's highly improbable. Now, I could also describe it bit by bit. I say the first bit is one, the second bit is zero, the third bit is, and so on. That's a very long description. Now, that same sort of description, even for Hamlet's soliloquy, would also count for any description. So anything can be described if you allow a long enough description. It's the short descriptions, because they're precisely because there are so few, when they describe an improbable event, very few things will then answer to it. And that's why, it ends up, those are the events, those that have the short description and are improbable. That's what tells us that we're dealing with intelligence. So that's
So
the
hold on
theoretical
a
nuts and
second.
bolts there.
I just want to clarify a bit. So when it's a long description, would that be similar to what we could talk about when we say computationally irreducible? That you just have to play out the whole program to find out what's going to happen?
I mean, it turns out that the vast majority of strings, bit strings, are require very long, I mean, re basically require programs as long as the bit strings. So there's no abbreviation possible. But it's when you have that abbreviation where you can describe things succinctly, low Kolmogorov complexity, and yet they're still improbable. That's when you get the design inference. That's what ends up being specified complexity.
So, have you looked at Stephen Wolfram's work at all?
I have. I mean, it's a new kind of science. I remember when that came out, and I was reading it.
No, his more recent stuff, though, where he's trying to develop a new theory of physics. And so he talks a lot about this. Well, his new theory of physics is actually looking at through a lens of how to use some of these principles that he worked out in the new kind of science to create a universe, to see how the universe might have come into being, let's put it that way. And so he talks about this idea of computationally irreducible in opposition to that which is computationally reducible. And basically, he says almost everything is, as you just said, almost everything is computationally irreducible. But we happen to live in the kind of a universe where there are certain slices of computational reducibility that allow us to be able to see through a lens, like you know, to see the laws of physics or to see chemical elements and things like that. Those are slices of computationally reducible information, so that we can make plans and build things. And because if everything were computationally irreducible, we would just have to let it all run out until the end of time and never know what's going to happen. So yeah. It seems to me like when you're talking about specified complexity, you're talking about one of these slices of computational reducibility.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's there's a resonance there. I mean, I think I may have looked at some of the more recent stuff of his, but I mean, you know, he was a Caltech wunderkind. You know, he got, you know, I think where his main intuition pump for science is cellular automata. And I think he's pushed that over the years. And cellular automata, you know, these are basically, you can represent them in a two-dimensional lattice where cells will change their state according to how other cells are behaving next to them. And you can do a lot with cellular automata. I mean, they're basically Turing complete. So you can run any computation there. The thing is, though, with Turing complete, you actually need the program, you know, so it's not like, you know, I mean, these cellular automata provide a Turing machine, but if you're actually going to run anything, you have to still put in the information.
Well, that's the really interesting thing about this theory he's working on, because when he first started with it, he was saying, we don't know what the rule was that generated the universe, but what if we could stumble upon it? And so he started working from that standpoint, that there is a rule that generated the universe, and that this rule, his concept is that space is composed of discrete particles, that space is not just a continuous place that objects are in, but that space itself is composed of discrete particles. And time is the updater of events. And the updating of events is composed of the rule being instituted at any given moment in time. And as the rule is instituted, the universe grows.
Yeah.
That's, well, very, yeah, simplified.
This sounds very similar. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, it's this discrete notion of things unfolding very much in the spirit of these cellular automata. But I mean, the thing is, these rules never contain all that much information. You have to go into the initial conditions, boundary conditions. The actual information for the universe to do anything interesting still needs to be accounted for. And that's why, I mean, rules, the information content in rules tends to be very limited. So, you know,
the only reason I brought it up, Bill, yeah, is that the conclusion he finally came to is that if he kept talking about a rule, people were going to accuse him of making God the designer of the universe.
Yeah.
So now he's talking about all possible rules being updated in all possible ways, which would mean that at every point in time, any given particle basically is updating basically, I mean, the way I see it, it has to mean that there's some sort of axiom of choice involved in that, that the particles must be choosing which path to take. So anyway, I think there are a lot of interesting implications in his theory. Whether it's true or not, it does make one begin to think about a lot of metaphysical things that they haven't been thinking of in the past. And so he describes this whole universe that he's creating as a ruliad, because it's the space of all possible rules being executed, you know, in all possible ways. And now he's come to the conclusion that for this all to be true, there has to be a hyper ruliad above the ruliad. So they keep moving one level up, just as you find when you start seeing this specified complexity, that there has to be something, a level up, that has permitted this information to come into being.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, that's this sort of regress, and I've seen it in many other circumstances. I mean, it also figures in. I mean, the follow-up to my work on specified complexity is something called conservation of information. And the idea there is if you have something that's it illustrates or exhibits specified complexity, and then short of accounting for it in terms of direct causal action by an intelligent agent, if you have to try to explain it in terms of some more secondary cause, the information problem only gets exacerbated. It pushes the information problem back. So in a sense, to this Rouillard or meta-Rouillard, you know, so I mean, there's a similarity there. Again, I haven't looked at his most recent work, but when I hear rules, I'm wondering if he's using rules in an idiosyncratic way, because when I think of rules, I think of, you know, I think of a heat equation or, you know, some, you know, Einstein's field equations or something, which describe, I mean, the rules by which certain processes in nature unfold. But I think
it's a way simpler rule than that. And I didn't want to derail us into that theory. I just wanted to point out that there are people who are stumbling upon the same thing that you've stumbled on.
I'm not sure I'd say same. I'd say it's
career.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd say same, but I mean, I think there are resonances. You know,
yeah.
I think we are trying to get at the same reality. But I think.
Well, so tell us about conservation of information.
Yeah, well, conservation of information, it arose by looking at the evolutionary computing literature. And what we would find is there'd be these claims that evolutionary processes could create information de novo or from scratch. And the thing is, this was done in a computational context because with computers, you can actually run evolution pretty quickly. If you're waiting for things to evolve in nature, you know, you can be waiting a long time. I mean, you know, so you're not going to be able to do a lot of experimentation. Now, granted, I mean, there are some organisms and viruses where you can do quite a bit of evolving. But anyway, so what we found, though, is that in this evolutionary computing literature, you'd have these claims being made that by setting up a replicatory context in which something like selection and variation were operating, we would get novel high information content entities that you know, that we shouldn't have expected, and that where it was basically created, you know, the language would often be from scratch, or you know, that it's novel information. But what we found was that invariably, whatever the information they got out of it had been smuggled in. So it became something of a game of follow the pea. You know, it's like where's the information being smuggled in? And then when I say we, there's a group of us centered around Baylor University. Robert Marks, he was head of this, still heads an evolutionary informatics lab, some of his students and myself. And so we would look at these systems, and then the challenge was, okay, to find in the program, because these are programs, often the source code was made available, and then we'd look at it and say, okay, where was the information that they claimed to be getting out for free was actually smuggled in? And the thing is, I mean, these evolutionary computing scenarios were used to try to support Darwinian evolutionary theory. Richard Dawkins, for instance, a well-known evolutionist and atheist, has said that what makes evolution such a neat theory is that it explains complexity of life in terms of primeval simplicity. So the idea is you can go from simplicity to complexity, and that you don't need any sort of design or any addition. You know, it's just these processes will work themselves out. And so what we found was that, in fact, you know, there was design being slipped in that they claimed that they were getting for free. So that was the start of it. But then the question arose, once you see something fail over and over again, you ask yourself, is there an underlying principle? I mean, think of, for instance, the search for perpetual motion machines. The U.S. Patent Office no longer allows applications for perpetual motion machines. Why? Well, the second law of thermodynamics rules out that you can get a perpetual motion machine to work. So that's a case in point. So what we found was that these, we kept finding that information that was supposed to be been gotten for free kept being smuggled in. So then the question was, well, is there a general theoretical grounds for that? And it turns out there is. And so what we would do is, what we did was, we described what was happening in these experiments, as searches. They were evolutionary searches. And the question was, they seem to be doing a lot better than blind search. Okay. And that's always the case with these evolutionary scenarios. They purport to solve needle in a haystack problems. And if you've got a needle in a haystack, you're going to need something better than blind search, blind chance to find them. So these evolutionary processes that they were setting up were doing better than blind chance. But the question then was, at what cost? And it turned out we could quantify that cost. And there were actually then some conservation of information theorems that we proved, which showed that the actual informational cost in raising these systems or these search procedures above random chance or above blind search had to be paid for basically by the same amount that they were getting out. So there was no, basically any benefit of these systems by what they were claiming to get was getting erased. And so I think an example would help illustrate this. So imagine that you've got a vast field and there's an Easter egg buried somewhere. The Easter egg is buried well. There's no way you should be able to find it given how vast the field is, okay? But now somebody shouts out to you, warmer, colder, warmer, warmer, colder, warmer, warmer, and so on. And then hot, you're burning up. And then you look down and there's the Easter egg, okay? So now what has happened, okay? If you, without those shout outs of, warmer and colder, you'd just be randomly searching around the, you have no special knowledge of where that egg is. So you have no advantage over blind search. But by me giving you or shouting out these directions, I've given you information, which has then helped you to find that egg. So even if the probability was one in a trillion trillion, now suddenly it's probability one. You're going to see that. So I've vastly increased the probability. It was a needle in the haystack problem. It's not anymore. Okay. So, but the question then is, well, where did those instructions come from? Because I could have shouted out hot, cold, in ways that would have taken you off the scent, that could have sent you any place, that would have avoided. And what you find is that the proportion of instructions that will get you to the egg, proportionately, it's no better than just where the egg is, the proportion of the egg in the field. So if it's in a sense, this has become term of use within this evolutionary informatics, conservation of information literature, but we talk about the search for the search. Okay, initially you were just searching for the egg. Now the search is for an instruction set that will get you to the egg. But it turns out when you look at the totality of instruction sets and use that as the denominator compared to all those instructions that get you there, it turns out that there's no improvement. It's as unlikely that you're going to find an instruction set that gets you to the egg as just doing a blind search for the egg. And in fact, it can be worse. It's called conservation of information because that's the best you can do, that you, that by doing a search for the search, you recover the probability for the original search, but it can actually be worse. And that suggests that unlike what Richard Dawkins was saying, that we're going from simplicity to complexity, the problem of the information problem as you backtrack in time actually becomes worse. So you either have to say that the information was always there and it was even more than we're seeing expressed now, or there was some sort of infusion of direct intelligence, because intelligences are able to create information. And so this is then the idea of conservation of information, that when a search is improved, the probability cost or information cost of improving the search erases any benefit that you might have encountered above blind search. Now, you've asked about also no free lunch. I mean, these conservation of information results are downstream, as it were, logically from the no free lunch. The no free lunch basically says that if you know nothing about where a target is in a search space, then any search is as good as any other search. I mean, you have to put a few constraints on it, but it's basically saying that there's nothing. You can have an evolutionary computing, hill climbing algorithm, a neural network, or whatever. All of these searches, they're not going to give you any advantage if you don't know anything about the target and the type of space that you're searching. So that's what no free lunch is saying. Any search is basically as good as any other. But the thing is, we know in practice that certain searches are better than others. So if a search is better for a particular target, what makes it better? What's the cost of getting that search? And that's what conservation of information is telling you. So it's an idea that's it's kind of the next step beyond the no free lunch theorems. The no free lunch theorems were proven by in the 1990s, mid 1990s, but then conservation of information, that really got going about 10, 15 years later.
Okay, so as you said at the beginning, your work has been highly controversial and it's affected your career and everything else. But in all those years, as you've worked on this, have you run across any good arguments against your work? What would you say is the best argument that somebody's come up with that would try to derail specified complexity? Because obviously, when you go to the Wikipedia page, they're saying, oh, it's been debunked and it's not
Yeah.
helpful and so forth.
Well, the Wikipedia page, I mean, it really can't be taken seriously, because I mean,
Yes,
if I
I
looked at
realize
it,
that.
it was 20, it was the state of the discussion 20 years ago. So they don't even cite any of the newer stuff. And I think I mean, specified complexity was a term of use. It had a lot of respectability from its inception in 1973, when Leslie Orgel introduced it, to actually the late 90s. I mean, Paul Davies was a well-known science writer and physicist, was pushing it. So I think Wikipedia, I think, just wants this idea to be dead, or at least to be discredited, so that it doesn't help intelligent design. So I see it mainly as a political thing. But to your point, I mean, conservation of information, it's a theorem. I mean, it's not like what's the weakness of it? Well, either it's right, either we proved it right or we didn't. But the thing is, we've published it. Okay, so we published it in a Japanese journal. I mean, so the full proof is there. Journal of Computational Intelligence and something informatics. It's a long title, so I never keep it in mind. But we published that in 2010. So I don't know. I mean, I guess it's supposed to be some sort of badge of respectability to be able to give some answer to say, well, yeah, there's this weakness or that.
Well, I
But
wasn't
I think
asking if
that,
there was a
yeah.
weakness. That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking you to steel man your opponent, I guess.
Yeah.
And because sometimes when you can look at the best opposition, you also find a little kernel of what
Yeah,
the
no, I know what you're saying, but I mean, I've engaged my critics and our critics at length. I mean, we just did a second edition of the Design Inference. There was a colleague, computer scientist, who's now a co-author, Winston Ewert, came out 25th anniversary edition, twice the length of the original. And so I deal with, or we deal with, objections that have been raised. And there, it's useful to address the objections, you know, because I think they call for clarification. But what I'm not finding is some sort of fundamental flaw. You know, I think a lot of what's described as supposed to be fundamental flaws don't end up working out. And it's interesting to me also the dynamic there where it seems people need to actually not just reject where the method is going. They don't like it that it's being applied to evolutionary biology and origin of life, but to have to actually you know, discredit the method itself, say that it's some sort of subpar use of probabilistic rationality. And that's just not the case. I mean, you know, I'm well-trained probabilist. You know, I know what's going on here, and this fits, you know, it fits very nicely with the existing literature. And I think it goes well beyond a lot of what I'm seeing, which is in a sense, poor man specified complexity. I mean, for instance, Robert Hazen is now touting what he calls a law of increasing functional information. I mean, it's a poor man's version of specified complexity because he has to tie the specification to a function, and that's becomes a very problematic notion, which he himself admits because it makes it contextual. You know, there's elements of human judgment that have to come in there, whereas specified complexity, by looking at minimum description length, is, yes, it's tied to a language, but even there are computational approaches where you can basically, it doesn't matter so much which language you use. They end up all being equivalent if you make certain broad assumptions about the type of language you're using. So I don't know, maybe I'm starting to sound defensive. You
No,
know, it's
not at all. And you answered my question well. I will put the design inference in the description section. So if anybody wants to look into the objections, they'll be able to find it.
yeah, this is the book. So it's the, and I would say get the second edition. This is the first edition, which was done in 1998. And this, it's, you know, completely superseded by this one. So,
Okay.
yeah.
And so I told you before that it was a commenter on one of my episodes that got you on my radar. I mean, I've watched some of your stuff in the past, but I just hadn't thought about, well, first of all, even the possibility of talking to you didn't occur to me. So this commenter was willing to put the two of us together. I don't know how he knows you, but one of his comments was that you show that in order for natural selection to de facto replace the role of a mind, it itself must have been designed by a mind. In other words, the environment must be as specified, improbable, and complex as the organism it creates. In other words, natural selection implies that the environment around the organism is as specified, improbable, and complex as the organism that is responding to the environment and ends up either surviving or not surviving the selection process. So I wondered if you might say something about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is an astute way of at least one way of drawing implications from this work, and it's right in line with conservation of information. So, and this is what we find in certainly in the evolutionary computing context. You know, when you get this output of so-called specified complexity, it ends up you have to build in the information in the system. And so by analogy, short of any sort of direct design intervention or surreptitious or guidance of nature, if you know, what your interlocutor describes is where the design or the information is front loaded, as it were. And you know, and that, you know, that's certainly consistent with with conservation of information. The thing is, there are other options available. I mean, you could have an intelligence that just intervenes. It could be miraculously, it could be through quantum processes, any sort of intervention at that level, you know, where you've got something, quantum process, it does it, do I go through this polarizing filter or don't I? Okay. Well, if an intelligence actually chooses which happens, we would never know because the you know it's a chance process. Now, we wouldn't know in the individual event, but in the conglomeration of the events, we might see some patterns that would get us to suspect that we're dealing with intelligence. But just you know the options are many there, but I think if you are dead set against any sort of interventionism, then I think you're going to have to say that the information was all there in advance, built in, as your friend said, in terms of the environment, the fitness of the environment, and the way the variation was working itself out. You know, so I think that's so yeah, it's what your friend said is consistent with conservation of information.
So I've also had a number of conversations with a developmental and synthetic biologist by the name of Michael Levin, who works with multicellular organisms, researching the biochemical and bioelectric signaling language that cells use with each other in order to do the work that they need to do that is not specified by DNA, because DNA only specifies the proteins. It doesn't give information about the body plan and how the body plan gets to completion. And he has recently been doing some research that leads him to believe that that organisms are, in some sense, being trained by the environment. They're responding to the environment, being trained by the environment, developing adaptivity based on the environment that they're in. But rather than coming to the conclusion that my commenter came to, that the environment must be specified, improbable, and complex from the get-go, they've come to the conclusion that the environment, well, they throw in this whole idea of niche construction, that the organisms themselves have impacted the environment. So the environment has changed in such a way that it then acts back on the organism to help it adapt more, and then the organism helps the niche of the environment to adapt more, and they're ratcheting each other up the scale, so to speak. Have you heard that argument before?
Well, I think I've seen things like that. I mean, there's a seems to be a kind of Lamarckianism that's going on there. You know, I think a colleague of mine, Rupert Sheldrake, I mean, he certainly talked about organisms being able to learn and then transmit that learning. And that learning, you know, makes perfect sense that the organisms would then shape their environments and their environments would in turn shape them. So, you know, and I think that happens even in human contexts and technological evolution. So there are many different types of evolution, and they don't need to be Darwinian. So this, you know, it sounds, I don't know if I want to say it sounds good. I want to look at it a bit more, but you know, I don't have, you know, it's not like I bristle against it as I do with Darwinism, which seems to be just, you know, want to dispense with any sort of intelligence or guidance. But you know, I think with the more interesting question for me though would still be what minimally needs to be the case for an organism to do this niche construction and then, as it were, have this positive feedback loop where, you know, and I use most positive feedback loops are bad, but this one, and where you've got the organism affecting the environment affecting the organism back, and there's some sort of progress through that. I mean, I think that sounds intriguing. There are some biologists who call themselves the third way. I mean, these ideas I think would be congenial to them. I think of James Shapiro, who will talk about natural genetic engineering, where basically organisms engineer themselves, and you know, it goes well beyond DNA. And as you point out, there's so much that happens. in organisms that cannot be reduced to genetics. So you've got the epigenetics and other things going on. So,
Do you
but
think that
I
would be a
still.
viable way, though, of the information in the DNA increasing? I mean, isn't that the implication that the simplest organisms have a simpler DNA, and then that over billions of years that this the information in the DNA has increased through complexity, this upward trajectory? Do you think this acting back on the environment would increase that information in the DNA?
I think you still have a minimum complexity problem because you've got to get some sort of basic organism in place to get the ball rolling. But it's not clear to me at all that this scheme of Michael Levin will take you from a prokaryote, a simple, single cell organism that doesn't have a nucleus. Can you get up to an organism with a nucleus? Can you then get multicellularity? Animals, I mean, I think what you've got is some sort of generic proposal, but you still need to kind of flesh that out in terms of, how would this happen? How would an environment interacting with the organism, an organism that is learning, how do you get that sort of level of complexity? I mean, I've got a cat that I like very much, but that cat's not going to learn quantum physics. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So, and I can adapt the environment as much as I like to that. So, and even there, I mean, if, leave aside the cat, but I mean, if with environments that are adapted, the niche construction, what are the limits there? And if something really remarkable happens, could it be because something remarkable has been embedded in the environment? So there's some information that's there. But often though, what I find in these sorts of evolutionary scenarios is that we just got to set up the right conditions and get the right recipe to start things off, and then all this cool stuff is just going to magically materialize. And I find that doesn't happen, or I find that very implausible. I mean, if intelligent design is real, and intelligent design doesn't mean optimal design. The reason we put intelligence in front of it is because so much of what the design in biology, as the Darwinists see it, doesn't involve actual intelligence. It's merely the appearance of design. But I mean, intelligent design, when we design things in technology, it's hard work. Yes, we can use pre-existing designs. There's technological evolution, but there's real insight that's needed. And this is what I'm not really finding with this kind of interaction of organisms that learn, and then an environment that they fit themselves to, and then the environment gives them some feedback, and then you have this kind of up and back. I don't, I think the details need to be put in how that actually leads to substantial increases in complexity in the organisms. I mean, if you've got a system that has feature and a precursor system didn't have that feature, how is that the emergence of that novel feature actually accounted for? And so this, to me, this seems like a very general framework, but you still need to come up with some specifics there. Now you might turn the tables and say, well, you intelligent design people, where are the specifics there? But the thing is, it's baked into intelligent design that that requires creativity, that there is this moment of insight, which is orthogonal to the physical processes. Physical processes are doing what they will, but the information that's needed. I mean, that's why, the ancient Greeks invoked the muses, to describe the creation of poetry, poetry, poema, a making, something that's created. I mean, this is, and it seems to me that there's just this emphasis these days in trying to circumvent the hard work of design and try to come up with something that doesn't require that. And I think some of it is just an allergic reaction to any form of theism, that does not want to admit that that there's something beyond us that we're not going to be able to get our minds fully around.
Well, one of the things I thought you might be interested in William in Michael Levin's work is that he is he approaches everything from the standpoint of, is this something that we could investigate? Not just theorize about, not just make up stuff in the air, but actually investigate through experiments. And he's done a lot of work with planaria, and planaria basically live forever, from what I understand, and that you can not only just cut one in half and it'll grow two new planaria, but you can cut it up into as many as 270 pieces and it will still regenerate full planaria. So he's been working on not exactly decoding, but finding alternative signals to use in place of this biochemical, bioelectric language that's being used. So if he cuts a planaria in half and gives it a certain signal, if it's the half that has the head on it, it will grow a head on the other half instead of growing the tail. And that creature is still has exactly the same DNA as the head and tail planaria, but it's perfectly viable and it would go on living that way. And if somebody found it in a stream someplace, they'd think that's what a planaria is because it's the same DNA. And likewise, if he cuts it in half and gives it a certain signal, it will grow a tail on the other side. So it'll have two tails and it's still functional. So then he started thinking, well, what could we do with tadpoles and frogs? And he's moved through this thing up to the point where they're almost at the place where they can regenerate a leg cut off of a frog using these signals, because it's, in a sense, this signal, this language is triggering some sort of a subroutine that's built into the creature, so that you trigger that subroutine and it will build a leg or it will build an eye in the particular place that you tell it to. So he's not talking about a designer or an intellect from the outside or anything like that. But it seems to me, if there's a subroutine in these creatures, that there's a designer someplace. It has to be. I mean, he's unwilling to talk about those implications, probably because he doesn't want to end up losing his career. But I mean, I might be implying too much, but there's something very different about his research. And I thought you might want to look into
Yeah, no, thank you. I think you mentioned it too. We corresponded, I think, about 2 months ago, and you mentioned it. And I took a quick look, and these are certainly fascinating creatures. I remember my dad; he was a biologist. He was a professor of biology, and I remember him once bringing home some planaria, and we did that. We took a razor blade, sliced them in two, and they grew back. It was. It brings back a memory. I haven't thought about that in years. He'd be 101 this year. That was in the 1960s. So, fascinating stuff. But I think from my vantage, it's still, and I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but there's, how do you get the organisms that do all this cool stuff in the first place? Once you have them, then it seems that there's all this genetic potential, epigenetic potential, all this stuff that you can play with. And I mean, it would be very interesting. I mean, is there any sort of signaling, any sort of information that could trigger in humans the regrowth of a limb? I mean, I
That's
don't
where
think
they're
it's
headed. That's where they're headed. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's I don't think it's it's a It's that it seems reasonable. I don't think we're close at this point, but it's certainly worth looking for.
Well, and here's one other principle that he's come up with that I thought was just fascinating, is that looking at cancer cells, and he describes it slightly different, but in my mind, a cancer cell has decided to remove itself from the community of cells and not participate anymore in what the cells are doing to make a whole being. So the cancer cell is off doing its own thing. If he gives it the right chemical or biochemical signal, it will come back to the community. So this would be a tremendous step forward in cancer research, right? If you could if you could communicate with the cancer cells and say, come on back.
Yeah.
And to me, all these things scale. So if it's something that's showing up at the cell level, it also scales at the human social level. And we're in the midst of a kind of a crisis in the world right now where so many people are isolating themselves and not being part of the community. So we need to, as you said, poetry is a way for this to happen, really, to bring people back into the community.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating because I think so much of the metaphorical language about cancer is battling, destroying, and to basically invite back into the rest of the body. That's if it can be made to work, I think it would be wonderful, but there's I'm reminded though of Ecclesiastes 3, there's a time for this and a time for that. I mean, it's time to lose, a time to find, a time to, for peace, a time for war. And so I wonder if there can come a point where things have gone too far and inviting isn't going to work and does have to be destruction. But but even the prospect of being able to deal with some cancers by inviting the cells back into the body, I think that's intriguing, and it would be beautiful if it could be made to work, even on a limited scale.
Well, maybe that's a good place to wrap up because it's
Yeah,
a very hopeful vision, right?
that's great. Thank you,
Yeah.
Karen.
This has been really, really rich. Thank you so much,
Yeah,
Dr.
likewise,
Lemke.
appreciate it. Yeah,
Okay. See
good.
you soon. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye. All right.